Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
On February 13, 1996, 8-year-old Debbie Sasson left her elementary school in Dusseldorf, Germany after a morning swimming lesson. She was heading home for lunch, but she never arrived. In the span of a 900-meter walk through her quiet neighborhood, Debbie vanished without a trace. Over the next 30 years, her family was torn apart and left to wonder what happened to the bright, bubbly little girl who everyone loved. While the case has remained unsolved for decades, recent developments mean that we may be closer to answers than ever before. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Debbie Sasson. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. So this week, we've got our third two-parter in a row.
Come on.
No, I'm joking. This one is actually not at all that. It's very straightforward. But it is slightly experimental because we have covered international cases before.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first one we've covered that's not from an English-speaking country.
Oh, yeah. I guess I didn't think about that.
Yeah. And
I mean, they all speak English in Germany.
Well, yes, of course. But their news media is not in English. So I haven't done one of these before, just honestly for that very reason, because I was concerned about using sources that weren't in English. But I decided to just, you know, go with God and Google Translate on this one and hope for the best. So I know we have a decent amount of German-speaking listeners, so I do want you to know that I am trying. I looked up the pronunciation of several words. I avoided several German words whenever possible, so I wouldn't screw it up that badly. So I had fewer opportunities to screw it up. But this case really hasn't made it over to America. So like literally, I could not find a single source in English other than a Reddit thread.
And you didn't even want to ask me about translations?
No. I've been to Germany with you.
And I spoke German.
Okay.
And they replied in English.
Yeah, and they told you to stop.
It's fine. I can speak a little bit.
Yeah, so more than me for sure. But no, so I Google translated articles. Like I said, that Reddit thread was really great as a jumping off point for me because it was written in English by somebody from Dusseldorf.
Mm.
So she was like, I say she. I got the impression it was a woman. It's Reddit. I have no idea. So I apologize for that. But that person had, you know, like a really local knowledge of it, you know. So that was helpful for me to kind of like get my head around the story a little bit so that I could then get into these weirdly translated articles. And it was funny because as I was reading them, I kept on forgetting because I'm dumb that they were translated. And so I'm going through them like,
this is really bad grammar.
I know. I was like, are Germans just like really bad at writing? And I was like, no. So I do hope we do this case justice. I mean, of course, I hope that for every case that we cover, regardless of the country of origin or the language or whatever. And, you know, if we do okay and people don't get too offended, then maybe we can branch out to other countries as well. But I really also wanted to cover this because we're right at the 30th anniversary of Debbie's disappearance. And I mean, this is going to go out about a week after, I think, her disappearance. So right around the 30th anniversary. And as I kind of mentioned in the intro, there have been new developments. So I feel like this is a great time to talk about this case that, as I mentioned, really hasn't made it over to America. Before we get into it, though, we've had a bunch of people join us over on Patreon, so we'd like to take a moment to give some of them a shout out. Thank you to May H, Jenna B, Melissa M, Amanda, Bethany D, Laza G, and Cassandra M. Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you all so much.
As a reminder, if you'd like to get our episodes ad-free and sometimes early, I'm trying to be better about that this season. They've all been like a full day early, by the way. And then obviously, if we do a two-parter, part two is a full week early. Yeah, if you're into that, you can join us over on Patreon at any level, starting at just $2 a month. And you'll also get a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. So now let's get into the story of Debbie Sasson. Deborah Sasson, whom everyone called Debbie, was a bright, energetic 8-year-old growing up in the Dusseldorf district of Würsten. Dusseldorf is a large city in western Germany, but the neighborhood of Würsten had a safe, close-knit feel in the 90s.
Good job pronouncing Würsten.
And I just saw you, like, looking at me. I know the W's sound like V's.
Yes.
And I know the EI and the IE are flipped from how they are in English. Those are, like, the two things I know about German. It wasn't unusual for children there to walk to and from school on their own. In fact, it was the norm. Debbie lived with her mother, Dagmar, her father, Jürgen, and her older sister, then 15-year-old Anita, on Kohlrauschweg, a street not far from her primary school. By all accounts, Debbie was a friendly, happy child. Family photos show a little girl with straight blonde hair and a shy smile. Tuesday, February 13th, 1996 was the day before Valentine's Day and part of the carnival season in Germany. I had to look up what carnival season was. It's a week-long celebration leading up to Ash Wednesday.
Got it.
Despite the festive time of year, it was an ordinary school day for Debbie. That morning, she attended classes at the Henri Dunant Elementary School on Rheindorfer Weg. The students had swim lessons that day, so Debbie had brought a swimsuit and towel in her backpack. After changing back into her clothes, Debbie briefly went back into the school to retrieve her bag, then exited the building through a back door leading to Weisdorfer Straße. Several of her classmates saw her leaving at about noon, and everything seemed normal. From that back exit, it was only about 900 meters, which is just over half a mile, to Debbie's home. And it was a walk that she made every day and should have taken her about 10 to 15 minutes. Debbie usually came straight home for lunch after school, and she was very punctual. Her mother, Dagmar, was working a shift that morning at a juice stand at a local shopping mall. Dagmar had kissed Debbie goodbye while the little girl was still waking up that morning and said, "Bye, my darling." By 12:30 p.m., Dagmar returned home expecting to find both of her children there. Instead, she was met by her older daughter, Anita, who was panicked. As soon as Dagmar walked in the door, Anita told her, "Debbie is not home." Dagmar immediately called the school, and they told her that Debbie had left at the usual time. In that moment, Dagmar knew that something was very wrong. And I do find it interesting that Anita was immediately panicked when Debbie didn't come home, because we have kids that have about that age gap.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly don't think our older boys would even notice.
Well, definitely.
The younger one didn't show up.
I mean, they don't know where he's at in our house when they're being paid to babysit him. So, like,
yeah.
You know, I can't imagine them like having to pay attention to when he comes home from school.
Right. And so to me, and you know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but like that says a lot about Anita, like who she was as a person and you know, what her relationship with Debbie and what their familial relationship was.
Yeah,
you know?
It also shows that Debbie was very routine.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that her older sister is freaking out when Debbie wasn't home in that short amount of time, like that, I mean, it does. It shows a lot about their
all of them,
routine.
I think, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I know you always ask about like family dynamics in these stories, so I'm going to say up front that in-depth information about Debbie's family is pretty scarce. In fact, her stepfather in all but one article is not even named. And so that's why like I only read that his name is Jürgen in one article, so like I'm hoping that's correct. But her biological father is never mentioned.
Mm.
So I don't know anything about him. Don't know his name. Don't know if he was involved at all. I mean, I'm thinking he wasn't involved because he never came up in any of the articles.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know if he's local. I don't know if he's alive. I mean, I know nothing about the biological father. But yeah, the articles all talked about Jürgen, the stepfather, and how he had raised Debbie since she was a baby. So like, that was her dad.
Yeah. I mean, we typically, I don't want to say in America, but, you know, generally speaking, that information comes out as a way to rule out potential suspects. Mm-hmm. So like in this case, not having any information about her biological father makes me wonder, you know, if he, A, is he alive? If, like you said, but if he is, could he be a potential kidnapper? Right.
Right.
But we don't know because there's no information, at least that was put out in the media.
Yeah. And what we'll get to, you know, way later is it doesn't sound like he was ever considered. So that just makes me feel like he just was not at all even in the picture, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So Jürgen got home, you know, sometime right around this time, right? And he, of course, freaked out and did what any dad would do. He rushed out to search the neighborhood. He walked what was Debbie's normal route between their house and the school, and then he took like an alternate route, you know, that would also get her to and from the school, but not the route she took, mm-hmm. because, you know, just in case.
Yeah.
But of course, there's still no sign of her. After two desperate hours of looking, Debbie's parents called the police to report her missing. Thankfully, authorities did not waste time. They realized immediately that an 8-year-old missing in broad daylight was an emergency. Go figure. Within hours, the Dusseldorf police launched what would become the largest search operation in the city's history up to that point. Around 40 officers were assigned to the case immediately. They combed the path from school to Debbie's home, going door to door to interview every resident in the area. They asked if anyone had seen the little blonde girl in the red coat or noticed anything unusual that afternoon. Officers blanketed the city with missing persons posters and flyers with Debbie's school photo on them. That Tuesday that Debbie disappeared was bitterly cold. In fact, the lake in Dusseldorf's Südpark was frozen over. And one of the passerbys that, you know, police were interviewing said that they had seen some children playing out on the ice that afternoon.
Ooh, don't like that.
Such a bad idea. So, of course, police feared the worst, you know. They're like, okay, this girl's very punctual. She, like, doesn't not come home, you know. Could she have gone out with some kids to play on the ice? Something terrible happened. So divers were dispatched, and twice they plunged into the frigid water, searching underneath the ice for any sign of the little girl. But they didn't find anything. Search teams literally turned over every stone they could. They checked bushes, alleyways, yards, and even manholes. But there was nothing. It was as if Debbie had disappeared into thin air. Dietmar Wixfort, the head of the special commission assigned to the case, later said, quote, "It's as if a hole opened up and swallowed her, along with everything she had with her," end quote. Because that's the thing, like, Debbie was wearing a lot of red.
Right.
She had red tights, she had a red coat, like, she was somebody that you would have noticed walking around. And, you know, if something had happened and her backpack, her coat, her, you know, some item of clothing had been left behind in the woods or whatever, like, it would have been easily spotted.
Right.
But it was nothing. Nobody found a single scrap of her. Police also immediately investigated the possibility of an abduction. I mean, I think once they...
I mean, that's where I'm going.
Of course.
If they can't find any sign of her around...
Yeah, if there's no sign and then the lake, you know, turned up nothing. It's
right.
Like, okay, well... The most common answers are out. So what do you have next? And what you have next is an abduction.
Yeah.
So they checked on known sex offenders in the region and systematically ruled out each one. Roadblocks were set up and drivers passing through the area were questioned. But in those first hours and days, no eyewitness to a kidnapping came forward. No one reported hearing a scream or seeing a struggle or anything like that. After the initial frantic search, police began piecing together whatever few clues they could find. A few children and parents recalled seeing a beige car near the school around the time Debbie left. There was reportedly a man inside the car, possibly watching the kids. Based on these accounts, authorities had a police artist draw up a composite sketch of the unknown man. Unfortunately, the descriptions were kind of vague, and I wasn't even able to find a copy of the sketch, just brief mentions of it in some of the articles. So the man in the beige car remained a phantom, and investigators couldn't even be certain that he had anything to do with Debbie's disappearance. As days turned into weeks with no clues, investigators tried to remain hopeful. They didn't refer to the investigation as a homicide case, keeping it officially as a missing persons case, because no one wanted to admit the possibility that Debbie might be dead. Investigators kept the case open and active, following up on every tip, but as weeks turned into months, there were no breakthroughs. No ransom calls came, and no witnesses reported anything that was super useful. Dusseldorf had never seen a case quite like this, a child disappearing in broad daylight on a short walk home, leaving no trace at all. Dagmar, Debbie's mother, later said that it felt like being trapped in a horror film on an endless loop. And it stayed that way for years. Police continued to follow leads as they came up, but few did. It was all just too much to bear. And in her absence, Debbie's family began to fall apart. I'm so excited to tell you about our sponsor, Avocado Green Mattress, because they have certified organic mattresses with thoughtfully chosen materials that are designed to support healthier living and more restorative sleep, which I know we all need. Because better sleep changes everything. It changes your morning, your moods, and your energy. And their products are built to last with durable, high-quality materials. Avocado products are an investment in long-term vitality. They're not a short-term fix. Plus, you can be sure that you'll have no regrets because you'll get a sleep trial of up to 1 year to ensure that you're getting the best mattress for you. When it comes to what you sleep on, real wins. Real is better. Go to avocadogreenmattress.com/ATTWG to check out their mattress and bedding sale. That's avocadogreenmattress.com/ATTWG. avocadogreenmattress.com/ATTWG. It's so cold, and the ice crashing off of my roof just shattered a table on my deck. So no, I don't really want to cook right now. Luckily, Factor makes healthy eating easy with fully prepared meals designed by dietitians and crafted by chefs. Ethan and I both have our own Factor meals coming, and I'm really excited because I'm a vegetarian, he's not, so we're able to get different things that we can have for lunch. He can take it to work and heat it up there. It's super easy. And they use quality functional ingredients, including lean proteins, whole foods, and healthy fats. Plus, they have 100 rotating weekly meals, so you're not just stuck eating the same thing over and over again, which honestly is why I can't meal prep. And they have many different options: high protein, calorie smart, Mediterranean, GLP-1 support, everything you could want. It's always fresh, never frozen, and ready in about 2 minutes with no prep and no stress. So if you want to try it out, you can head to factormeals.com/ATTWG50off and use code ATTWG50off to get 50% off and free breakfast for a year. Eat like a pro this month with Factor. New subscribers only, varies by plan. One free breakfast item per box for 1 year while subscription is active. Most of us are trying to get healthier, but we're guessing about which habits actually matter for our bodies, and we're all different. So what if you can measure how your body is aging and know exactly what to focus on next? Listen, I need instructions, and that's what True Diagnostic does. They test your biological age and key health markers, and then they give you a clear 90-day plan based on what your body needs without the guesswork. The test is so easy to take at home. They send you the kit, you take a little finger prick, send it in, and then you get this amazingly detailed report back that tells you everything you need to know. I'm so excited to get my next round of results to see if I've improved or what's changed in general since the last time I took it. I'm really interested in the True Health test, which tests over 105 biomarkers, including vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and fatty acids, to understand my system's health right now. True Diagnostic is trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. And right now, my listeners can get 20% off at truediagnostic.com using code ATTWG20 at checkout. That's truediagnostic.com and use code ATTWG20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the combo kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. In the years following 1996, Debbie's mother Dagmar dealt with overwhelming depression, as you can imagine. And, you know, one thing I will stop and say is that one thing I noticed in the coverage of this case, as opposed to like the American cases that we've covered, is they really were very blunt about the struggles that the family went through, especially Dagmar. And I feel like in America, we don't really get into that much usually. You know, of course, you get the interviews with the parents and they talk about how sad they are and everything, but they really get into it with Dagmar, and not in a way that I think is exploiting her. Mm-hmm. It's just very direct and very real about like what it actually looks like for a parent who's in this situation. And I just thought it was really, you know, obviously tragic and horrible, but very just interesting from, you know, the perspective of somebody who has covered hundreds of these cases in America, and just like how different the media coverage is.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting to note that we've seen this a lot in cases here in America where the media coverage of how families are responding to something like this.
Oh, it's picked apart.
Yes, it's used against them.
Yeah.
So it is interesting that in Germany, it's not only not used against them and picked apart, it's the driving factor of the story.
It really is, honestly. And it is really interesting because they're like, I can sum up the majority of the articles that I read for this case as Dagmar fell apart, obviously. Like, yeah. that was, you know what I mean?
Right.
So Dagmar's trauma manifested itself as severe anxiety and even an eating disorder. She developed bulimia, and her weight at one point dropped to around 32 kilos, which is 70 pounds.
Yikes.
She later admitted, quote, "I thought I couldn't eat while Debbie might be somewhere starving," end quote. Which, like, that broke my heart, you know? And that's such, like, a raw look into, again, like I was saying, the mindset of somebody who's going through the worst thing possible. Dagmar also began relying on Valium and alcohol to numb her pain. She attempted suicide multiple times in the aftermath of Debbie's disappearance. Dagmar described those years succinctly, quote, "Little by little, it ate away at my soul," end quote. Nevertheless, Dagmar and her husband tried to persevere. In the years after Debbie vanished, they ended up having two more daughters together.
Wow.
And I don't know if it was an effort to give Dagmar a reason to live or to just have some positivity in an impossibly tragic situation, but the babies also brought about complicated feelings. Dagmar sometimes felt guilty for experiencing love and joy with her new daughters while one was still missing. Damn it. This is one of those episodes that I was fine when I was writing it, but now as we're recording, it's ugh. She said that as she found herself loving the two little ones, she would sometimes ask, quote, "What kind of terrible mother would I be to move on?" end quote. Of course, loving her other children didn't make her a terrible mother at all. She was just trying to be a parent while dealing with unimaginable grief. But of course, Dagmar wasn't the only one in the house who was suffering. Her husband was also grieving while raising three other children and trying to help a wife who was falling apart at the seams. Debbie's older sister, Anita, had been 15 in 1996. She was a teenager who was old enough to fully grasp the horror of what had happened to her little sister, and it shattered her world. She became deeply depressed and angry. Dagmar later said that Anita coped the least well with Debbie's disappearance. Quote, she was so angry at this world that something like this can happen, end quote. For 3.5 years, she and the family lived in limbo, not knowing what happened to Debbie. Anita struggled to carry on, but in late summer 1999, Anita couldn't bear it any longer. She died by suicide at just 19 years old. She hanged herself in the attic of their home, the same home where she had last seen her little sister alive. Dagmar, who was only hanging on by a thread prior to Anita's death, finally broke. She couldn't do it anymore. She couldn't stay in that house. She couldn't stay in Dusseldorf. She loved her two younger daughters, but she knew she couldn't be a mother to them. She and Jürgen separated, and Dagmar moved to Germany's northern coast, to the Baltic Sea. She left her younger daughters in their father's care, believing that they would be better off with him, while she just tried to survive each day. In an interview, Dagmar later said that she was afraid. She had been suicidal at that time, and she was afraid that she would get to the point where she would take the girls with her.
Oh, geez.
So she left because she thought it was the only way to keep them safe. Jürgen stayed in Dusseldorf to raise the two younger daughters. He reportedly did an admirable job as a father under the circumstances. But in a rare interview, he said that he has essentially lived two lives. With one article saying, quote, he has divided his life into the one he leads today and the one in which Debbie, Anita, and the mother of his children existed, end quote. Though Dagmar had to leave her life in Dusseldorf behind, she never stopped fighting for answers in Debbie's case. The not knowing ate at her, especially because she believed that Debbie could still be out there somewhere. She told a reporter, quote, I cry for Anita. I saw her again after her suicide at the medical examiner's. I do not cry for Debbie. I could only do that if I knew she was no longer alive. I should feel it. Shouldn't I? I don't feel it. End quote. Meaning she would feel it if her daughter was dead.
Right.
Thankfully, police also never gave up on finding answers in Debbie's case. Her case file apparently grew so large that extra shelves had to be installed in the lead detective's office. Dietmar Wixford, the detective who led the initial task force, continued to pursue the case well beyond 1996. He was eventually promoted and transferred to another city, but colleagues said that he kept Debbie's case in his mind, and if he heard even a vague lead, he would follow up on it. The disappearance of Debbie Sassen stayed in the public memory around Dusseldorf, too. It became a local cautionary tale. And, you know, I mentioned at the beginning that Reddit article that I read.
Mm-hmm.
The author is from Dusseldorf and said that this was one of the cases that their parents used to teach them about stranger danger.
Mm.
This case has obviously remained unsolved for 30 years, but that doesn't mean that there haven't been persons of interest or specific avenues that investigators have gone down. So let's talk about some of them. In May 1996, just 3 months after Debbie vanished, an 11-year-old girl named Claudia Roof was abducted from the nearby town of Grevenbroich. Claudia's body was found 2 days later. She had been sexually assaulted and killed. Naturally, this led the public and investigators to wonder if there was a serial predator in the area and if Claudia's murder and Debbie's disappearance could be linked. After all, both crimes involved young girls in the same region within a short time frame. However, the case had different profiles. Claudia was taken while walking a dog on a country lane, and her body was left in a different town, whereas Debbie vanished in an urban area and was never found.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the difference between the two, well, it's not actually a difference. I mean, for me, in Debbie's case, I think that her routine was kind of almost her downfall, potentially, because this was probably somebody who, like, cased out school, obviously noticed Debbie.
Yeah.
And noticed that Debbie's routine was the same every day.
Yeah, it does sound like it was.
Potentially able to plan a spot where he knew that he could abduct her and nobody would see.
Yeah, and I'd be interested to know if Claudia, like, walked her dog at the same
time every day. Like, yeah, the school, you could say, oh, it was mildly opportunistic because they just drove up and sat next to a school until he saw somebody.
Right, and there were tons of kids and, you know.
Right, but it's an urban area and nobody saw anything.
Right.
So to me, that suggests that this was planned and he knew the specific spot he was going to take her. Which, then in the other case, she's on a country road, so there had to have been some sort of surveillance or planning to know that she would be there.
Or just crazy, crazy luck.
Yeah, well, sure. Yeah.
You know? Yeah, I don't know. But I do find it interesting that Debbie disappeared in February and 30 years later has not been found.
Mm-hmm.
Claudia was taken 3 months later and her body was found fairly quickly. So to me, it's like if you get away with something like that.
Yeah.
Are you really going to do a worse job?
Yeah, I was going to say, typically you get better at it as it progresses, as opposed to, you know,
but, you know,
back.
Again, and, you know, we're not criminalists or psychologists or anything, but I could also see potentially like, okay, you get away with something, you do it, and you're like, oh my God, this is great. And we did it. But then, like, you kind of, the next time, you're almost like in a frenzy, right? Because mm-hmm. you know how it's going to be. And so maybe you get sloppy because you're overly eager or whatever.
Yeah. Or maybe something happened that
they got interrupted. Yeah. You know, anything
disrupted
yeah.
the chain of events that didn't happen on the first case.
Right. Now, decades later, DNA evidence was obtained in Claudia's case, which led to a massive DNA screening of local men. But unfortunately, no match was found. And as of this recording, Claudia's murder remains unsolved, and police aren't sure if her case is linked to Debbie's.
Now, were there additional instances of things like this happening in and around the same time, same geographic area?
That was the only specific one that I saw mentioned in relation to Debbie's case.
Because my thought would be, you know, he essentially got away with it twice.
Right.
That behavior doesn't just stop.
No, but also, I mean, you know, the thing about Europe is it's so small, right? And I just it's feel true. Like yeah, could just go to another country.
Right. He may not have
He could be in Austria.
Yeah, he may
know?
Not have actually been a
Belgium,
German
like,
citizen either.
Exactly. Like, you don't know. And so I think it's, there. You're right, there very much could have been other cases that are linked, but happened in completely different places.
Yeah.
Another infamous criminal loomed large in 1996. Marc Dutro, a Belgian pedophile and murderer who was arrested in the summer of that year. Dutro abducted and murdered multiple girls. His crimes were so horrific and far-reaching that investigators across Europe scrutinized any child disappearances for a possible connection. In Debbie's case, Dusseldorf investigators even traveled to Belgium at one point to investigate Dutro and see if he might have been involved in her disappearance. Now, it was a long shot because honestly, they had no evidence of this other than the fact that he abducted and murdered girls.
Right. But, I mean, you got to try.
Yeah, absolutely. And they did. But unfortunately, no link was found. There was no evidence that Dutro had operated in Germany or that he knew of Debbie. Unfortunately, like many of the stories we've covered over the years, Debbie's family was subjected to cruel hoaxes. A few years into the investigation, the Sasson family received an anonymous letter claiming that Debbie's body was in the bottom of Halterner Sea, a lake in a different part of Germany. The letter was specific enough that police took it seriously and undertook a large-scale search of that lake. Divers and sonar scoured it, and officers combed the area, but found nothing. The letter was eventually traced to a theology student, of all people, who had written it as a joke for attention. He was later convicted and even made to pay for the cost of the search effort, which I actually love. And I have not heard of in any of the hoaxes that we've covered in other stories.
Yeah.
So love that for him. Hope he was financially very hurt by that. Because there's so little direct evidence in the case, there have been lots of theories over the years. So let's talk about them. When the investigation first started, obviously police looked into the parents and other people close to Debbie. But when those avenues proved to be fruitless, investigators started looking at it as a possible stranger abduction. The idea here is that maybe a traveling predator or someone driving through, like the mysterious man in the beige car, snatched Debbie. Dusseldorf is a big city, and Versten is not far from major roads, so if a stranger with a car took her, he could have been out of the city within minutes. And a person like that might have been a complete unknown with no ties to Debbie, which would explain the utter lack of clues. But the problem is that the abduction took place on a city street at lunchtime, and no one noticed anything. Of course, that doesn't mean it's impossible. Children have been abducted in broad daylight before. But usually there's at least a witness who heard a scream or saw a struggle, but not in Debbie's case. Even so, a stranger could have coerced Debbie rather than just, you know, snatching her. Like they could have asked her for help or something along those lines.
Right.
And so if it was a coercion by a stranger, that's not something that a witness would necessarily notice. So if a stranger did it, they could have taken Debbie far away, even across international borders. One theory at the time was that she might have been taken to Belgium or the Netherlands, which are not far from Dusseldorf, especially in light of the Dutro case. Now, another kind of related theory is that it wasn't a planned abduction, but an accident and a cover-up.
Like somebody accidentally hit her with their car and then threw her body in the car and drove away.
Exactly.
And then broad day urban street, nobody saw that. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
I think that's pretty far-fetched.
I do. I think that's a little bit more far-fetched than the stranger abduction theory, honestly, because you're right. I think that if she was hit by a car or something along those lines, somebody would have seen or heard something. And we've talked about that too. I mean, in multiple cases, but the one that comes to mind is the Michael Vaughn case, because that was one of the theories in his case that, you know, he was out playing and they thought, well, maybe somebody in the neighborhood hit him with the car and, you know, panicked and hit him. But it's the same thing. Like, it was a busy neighborhood. Like, a lot of people were out. Nobody heard anything. Nobody saw anything. It just did not seem likely. And as we've learned, that doesn't seem to have been what happened with him at all. So yes, kind of the same thing here, right? Like, I just can't see noon in Dusseldorf,
right?
Like that occurring. Illegal adoption and human trafficking have also come up over the years, but I also don't buy that. While illegal adoption or something along those lines can be a viable theory, like the Andre Bryant case that we covered in the beginning of this season, snatching a random 8-year-old girl off the street for this purpose doesn't seem extremely likely to me. Because 8 is enough that you, like, you know who you are.
Right,
you know,
yeah,
who your family is.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
You know, even if you do get sold, you have memories of your family. It's not like a toddler or somebody that, you know, is young, so young that they don't remember anything and they can just be told
who they are.
Who they are. This,
yeah,
is your family. That sort of thing.
Yeah, so that didn't seem super likely to me. In terms of the human trafficking angle, there's usually more of a grooming aspect,
yeah,
to that.
Yeah, and we've talked about that before.
And we've
too
talked about many, 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 many times.
Yeah.
Because anytime a girl or a woman is abducted, like, human trafficking always comes up. And sometimes, again, it's a viable theory. But
again, same thing. Like, in this case, like, a stranger abduction of a random 8-year-old to be sold into human trafficking, it just, that's not typically how it goes.
Yeah.
There would almost be more effort to do it that way, because,
right,
you're starting from scratch with the drugging and the grooming behaviors.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's far more likely that I'm going with my original theory. This guy staked out the school, picked her out probably because she was wearing a red jacket and it was noticeable. And noticed her routine and figured out a spot along the route where he could get out and take her.
Well, yeah. And so that does bring us to our next theory, which is kind of that, right? But like not a stranger. So not necessarily just a stranger who decided to park in front of the school and just like see what happened, but an abduction by a neighbor or an acquaintance, like somebody who was familiar with the area and maybe even familiar with her.
Right, which would explain the potential of her getting into the car voluntarily.
Exactly. And this theory aligns with new information that has come out in the past year or so, including new information that's come out in January 2026, shortly before we're recording this episode. Armoir makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoir, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your personalized closet. Then they show up to your door in as little as 2 days. And let me tell you, I'm on the other side of the country and they still got here super quick. Then when you're ready for new clothes, you just swap them out. I'm an elder millennial, and so jeans are kind of like the thing that I can't figure out right now. And so in my new bag that I just got, I ordered 2 different pairs of jeans because I'm still trying to figure out what actually works for me. And I love it because I can rent high quality designer clothes without having to make that financial investment. Plus, there's no laundry required and no time wasted shopping. So right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 60% off of their first month. That's up to $150 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, A-R-M-O-I-R-E, .style/ATTWG to get up to 60% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. At the very end of January 2026, news broke that gave Debbie's case its first real jolt of progress in decades. On January 26th and 27th, 2026, a flurry of police activity erupted in the Dusseldorf-Fürsten area, the very same neighborhood where Debbie had disappeared. Residents saw police cars and even what appeared to be tactical units, and rumors spread that it was related to Debbie's case. Soon after, authorities confirmed it publicly. They had a new lead in the disappearance of Debbie Sasson, and they were actively pursuing it.
Wow, 30 years later.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
That's like why I wanted to do this episode. In a joint statement on January 27, 2026, the Dusseldorf police and the city prosecutor's office announced that they were following up on further investigative leads in this cold case. They said that extensive police measures had led to new avenues for investigation. Not only did they have new avenues, they had a specific suspect. They haven't named this person since no one has been charged as of this recording, but they provided a couple of key details. First, they explicitly said that the suspect is not someone from Debbie's family.
Okay.
So that's kind of why I was saying that, like, the biological father is not even like an issue in this.
Yeah, yeah.
The police made it clear that they are not investigating the family in this renewed effort. Second, they said the suspect is a man who back in 1996 had access to the properties that were now being searched.
Interesting.
Now, that second detail is especially intriguing. It suggests that the suspect may have been someone like a landlord or a building manager or a service technician or anyone whose job granted him keys or entry to certain buildings in the neighborhood at the time Debbie disappeared. Because they said access.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, they didn't say it was somebody who lived there.
Yeah.
They didn't say anything like that. I think access to is a very important choice of wording. And to Dagmar, one person came immediately to mind, a former neighbor of theirs. So somebody who actually did live there, but they didn't just live there. So in interviews given after this news, Dagmar revealed that she herself had long been suspicious of a man who used to live nearby and who had even interacted with the family. This man worked as a sewer maintenance worker in 1996. Because of his job, he had keys to various sewer access points and possibly to certain utility areas in people's homes around Dusseldorf. So that's the thing. So it's like the police said access to.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Dagmar is thinking of a neighbor, but I think the places where the police were searching weren't necessarily where this guy lived.
Right.
Dagmar says that 30 years ago, she couldn't shake the feeling that this neighbor might have had something to do with Debbie's disappearance. Now, at the time, it was just a gut feeling without any evidence, and police didn't really seem to focus in on it. But now, hearing that the suspect had access to the locations being searched, Dagmar wonders if that man is finally under the microscope. Dagmar traveled back to Dusseldorf for the searches and gave interviews, and in one article, it said, quote, "Now she stands before many questions, the most important of which is, what does this man know about Debbie?" End quote. Now, this search was part of a 2-day operation, like I said, January 26th and 27th of 2026. According to press releases and news reports, police executed searches at multiple locations tied to the suspect. Specifically, 5 apartments and 1 house in Dusseldorf were searched, including at least 1 property in Versten that is very close to Debbie's old school. The searches were carried out by detectives from the homicide squad with support from the riot police, who are used for securing areas, and specialists from the BKA, the Federal Criminal Police Office, which often assists in cold cases. Apparently, anytime the BKA is involved, you know it's a major operation. These searches took place on the 26th and the 27th, nearly 30 years to the day since Debbie disappeared. During the searches, possible evidence was seized from the various properties. Police have not revealed what these items were, and of course, analysis is still ongoing as of this recording. One particular focus of this operation was a Zika Gruba, which translates to a drainage pit or cesspit.
Mm.
In some older properties, these are underground pits where wastewater or rainwater collects and gradually seeps into the ground.
A good place to hide a body.
Yeah, that's what they were thinking. According to the Rhenish Post, the police emptied a drainage pit and excavated the soil around it during the search. The pit was located just a few hundred meters from Debbie's elementary school, right in the vicinity of her disappearance. It seems that the investigators suspected that Debbie's remains might have been hidden in that pit back in 1996. If the suspect indeed was a sewer worker with keys to sewer infrastructure, that theory makes a lot of sense. It would have been a place no one would think to look, a literal hole in the ground that could swallow something up and keep it hidden.
So who is this guy?
We don't know. Nobody has said his name.
So we don't even know if this guy's still alive.
No. No idea. Unfortunately, after thoroughly pumping out and digging up the pit, no human remains were found. Chief Prosecutor Murat Yilmaz, who has been speaking for the authorities on this case, said in a press statement, quote, "We have unfortunately not found Debbie," end quote. However, he also confirmed that, yes, they did have a concrete suspect in their sights, but he didn't offer any more details about the man's identity or what exactly prompted these searches. Reporters tried to get more information out of him, you know, like whether or not the suspect had prior convictions, like maybe for sexual offenses.
Mm-hmm.
But Yilmaz declined to comment, citing investigative,
You know. It's an ongoing investigation.
Exactly. All he would say is that specialists were brought in for the searches and that evidence was seized and is being examined. Since they were being stonewalled, the media started digging on its own. The newspaper Bild reported that, according to their police sources, the suspect was not on the radar back then and no longer lives in Dusseldorf, Würsten. So, sounds like he is still alive, but not in the area. Bild also reported that ground-penetrating radar was used to find any hidden voids or burial spots. Now, listen, I know it makes investigative sense to keep the identity of the suspect under wraps at this early stage, but it's so frustrating.
I mean, yes, it's frustrating
for us.
For us.
For us. But people who don't matter.
Yeah.
Yes. Because it just leaves us with more questions. Like, how did this person stay under the radar for so long? And if it is the neighbor Dagmar thought of, did police actually interview him, you know, at the very beginning? Because it does sound like they were really thorough in interviewing everybody in the area. So, like, what happened there? You know, was it just that he didn't have a criminal record? Like, what was it about this guy if he was interviewed that police didn't follow up, you know? Like,
yeah, I mean, I'm more curious as to how they landed on him 30 years later.
I know.
And what has he been doing for 30 years? Because that's the other thing is...
Yeah, what has he been doing? That's the big thing.
You know, we've said this before. I think we said it earlier in this episode. That type of behavior doesn't just stop.
Correct. Yeah.
So...
What's his
does
deal?
Does he have a long list of victims? Or did the behavior stop because he was in jail?
Another good question. We have no idea. And so, yeah, back to, like, how did he come up 30 years later? I mean... We can only speculate, like maybe someone came forward with new information about him. The police have mentioned new witness hints, which I'm sure is just like a weird translation because that's kind of an odd.
A witness hint.
A witness hint.
Wink, wink.
Yeah, right. But yes, new witness hints that moved the case forward. For Debbie's mother, Dagmar, the recent developments in her daughter's case have brought a mixture of hope and frustration. The frustration stems from the fact that she was not informed about this new investigation ahead of time. She found out when the news broke to the public, like everyone else. So obviously that upset her.
Yeah.
She felt that she deserved to be kept in the loop, which I completely agree with. Dagmar even went to the media and made an appeal asking the police to please communicate with her. Only then did the cold case investigators sit down with her and explain some of what was going on. And again, I understand you can't tell the mom, like, everything that you know,
like
everything about
the
suspect.
The person, right.
Yeah, and I get that. But, like, to do these searches and to say, hey, we've got huge news in this 30-year-old cold case and not give her a heads up?
Yeah.
Like, no.
Yeah, it's kind of fucked up.
It is. You can at least tell her just that. New leads, gonna do some searches. That's it. Like, she did not deserve to find out on the news. And even then, after, like, she actually got her sit down with detectives, she got contradictory statements from different officials about what they were finding and what they were looking for. And yes, some of that, again, you don't want to give up everything, but get your story straight, like, before you talk to the mom. Dagmar also gave interviews imploring anyone who knows something to come forward. And in a move that must have been incredibly difficult, she addressed the suspect directly in a plea via the media. Essentially, she said, if you're responsible or if you know what happened, just tell us. You know, she's been searching for her daughter for 30 years and all she wants at this point is the truth. And I think we've seen that in a lot of these stories, right? Where after so many years go by, I think for a lot of families, the desire for vengeance or punishment goes away. Like, they just want to know.
Yeah, the families do.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
But coming forward, I mean, you're going to, justice will be served.
For sure. But, like, that's not what she cares about right now. I'm sure it would have been a different story in 1996.
Very true.
But in 2026, like, she just wants to know where her little girl is. Even if it's the worst truth imaginable, she needs to know. Dagmar is now in her mid-60s, and she's fighting her second battle with cancer on top of everything else. She has said that she believes the stress and heartbreak she's endured has contributed to her illnesses. As of this recording in February 2026, no arrest has been made in connection with Debbie Sasson's case. Prosecutor Ayomez confirmed that while they have a suspect, he was not in custody at the end of January 2026. Which makes sense, right? Because investigators have a long road ahead of them. They really need to carefully build their case, and they're likely waiting for the forensic results from the seized evidence before they move ahead with anything.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, they're trying, they're almost starting to build the case from scratch 30 years later.
Yes.
So, like, I'm sure a lot of evidence has been lost to time already.
Right. And but, and again, with, you know, a case like this, it's an uphill battle from the very beginning because right. you don't have a body. You don't necessarily have a crime scene. Like, you just don't have those things that investigators have in a homicide case, for instance. So, like, you're starting from, like, less than square one. You're starting right. from, like, square negative three. And then add 30 years to it. It's a long road. So like in America, there's no statute of limitations on murder in Germany. However, if hypothetically the evidence doesn't support a murder charge, but only a lesser charge like manslaughter, the clock might be an issue. Manslaughter in Germany can have a statute of limitations of 20 years, which is possibly extendable to 30 in some circumstances. So 2026, we're right at the threshold. That could mean that prosecutors will really want to make sure that they have enough evidence for a murder indictment specifically. So they may need to show that it was part of another crime like sexual assault or kidnapping, which, to be fair, showing that it's a part of kidnapping should be pretty easy.
Yeah.
But it means that the investigation may take more time. But again, hopefully they'll be able to uncover the evidence that they need. I mentioned at the top of the episode that one of the reasons I wanted to cover this case is because of the recent developments. It's tough doing a show that's only unsolved cases because people like endings. It's human nature. We want our stories wrapped up with a bow. But the fact that we're seeing such a flurry of activity nearly 30 years on just demonstrates why covering these cases is so important to me. Because there's always, always hope for answers. The pain that the families of long-term missing people feel doesn't go away, and neither should the hope. For Dagmar, a mother who has been hit over and over again with grief and health problems, the hope is all she has. She's endured more than anyone ever should. The loss of one daughter to presumed violence, another to suicide, and a lifetime of not knowing. If this case is actually on the verge of being solved, it's not a moment too soon. As Dagmar asked in an interview with the Stern, quote, "How much suffering can a mother endure?" End quote. Deborah Debbie Sasson has been missing from Dusseldorf, Germany since February 13, 1996. She is a white female, and at the time of her disappearance, she was approximately 3'9" tall with blonde hair and blue eyes. She was last seen wearing a red down jacket, plaid shirt, striped vest, red skirt, red tights, and brown boots. She was carrying a red satchel and a blue gym bag. Debbie was 8 when she went missing. She will be 38 today. If you have any information on Debbie Sasson's disappearance, please call Dusseldorf Police at 0211-8700. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!